Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Takeaway.org. What kind of an idea is that? So if you look at the front page of the New York Times, we've got a couple of stories that we certainly had questions about and we wanted to get more information. We begin in Iraq with Ian Fisher, a New York Times reporter, who writes that the real test of these upcoming elections in Iraq that Femi was just talking about will be to pay attention to what happens in the city of Mosul, where violence is still rampant, and whether a new political system is going to be a step towards stability in that very divided city. Ian is in Baghdad today, but his front page piece is all about the city of Mosul. Good morning, Ian.
Good morning.
Why is Mosul so important in your view, and what signs do we have that indicate how important this election is going to be?
Well, Mosul is important, for one big reason, and that is that the violence is still going on. I mean, after the sort of surge and the sort of cooperation from the Sunni tribes, most of Iraq has been relatively quiet, if kind of fragilely. I think people were tired. People are sort of looking toward the future a bit. And what Mosul shows is an election in a place where the emotions and the violence is very raw. So the issue sort of plays itself out politically in that in 2005, the Arab groups boycotted. And so Kurdish groups, who are their sort of are their rivals, picked up 31 out of 41 seats. Now the Arabs are not boycotting. In fact, they're fighting very, very hard. It looks like they're going to win. So it looks like there'll be a much more representative council. Thus, the question is: will a kind of political inclusion reduce the violence with these groups that some of whom may, it's believed, have a political agenda rather than merely a religious one?
Ian, tell me the flavor of this campaign in the sense that the Arab parties have decided to participate. Have they given you a reason why and their sense of confidence going in here?
Well, precisely what I just said. I mean, they boycotted in 2005. After that, an extraordinary amount of violence exploded in Mosul and around the country, but it's persisted in Mosul. And essentially, they say, look, the violence didn't work. Let's participate in these elections, and we will have a council that, again, more accurately reflects the ethnic makeup. So Mosul is probably, I don't know, two-thirds Arab, possibly a third Kurd, with other minorities represented. So the argument goes, and some people aren't sure, you know, entirely how true it is, that greater representation equals fairer politics equals less violence.
But I guess what I'm asking is the quality of the sort of violent sectarian rivalry in Mosul reflected in the rhetoric in the campaign? In other words, are they saying, you know, we're going to clobber you, or are they saying we want to join in some sort of dialogue and move forward? You know, that kind of political neutral blah, blah, blah that you hear all the time in the United States.
That's interesting. It's a little bit of both. On one hand, everybody there sort of realizes that for things to work long term, they're going to have to cooperate. The Kurdish group has pledged to work with one of the two Arab parties. Both of the Arab parties say they'll work with the Kurdish groups. So there is some sense of let's all come together. On the other hand, they are beating themselves up mightily, with each side, you know, taking a sectarian line against the other. The Kurds say that the Arabs are cheating and intimidating and driving people out of Mosul. The Arabs say that the Kurds are trying to sort of make gains in the region between Mosul and the independent enclave of Kurdistan, kind of shoring up their enclave
right
there.
Quite
so
a mix.
So again, it's a bit of both.
And it's quite a mix, and we'll definitely see the outcome, or, you know, as early as Saturday, although the results probably won't be in, but the voting will take place on Saturday. Ian Fisher in Baghdad from the New York Times, extending on the story that he's got on the front page this morning. Also on the front page this morning is a bit of a spy novel. Eric Lichtbau is here to explain from the New York Times Washington Bureau. He's the author of Bush's Law, The Remaking of American Justice. Right off the bat, Eric, how can somebody still be a spy if they're in prison?
Well, pretty remarkable story. You wouldn't think they could. In this case, Harold Nicholson, who was one of the more notorious spies from the 1990s, a high-ranking CIA officer, used his son, his 24-year-old son, to allegedly continue spying for the Russians, passing on information that he had gathered before he was in prison, particularly things like counterterrorism detection methods, ways of avoiding capture by Americans, to send his son out and have him meet in spots around the world, from Lima, Peru, to Mexico City, to Cyprus, and collect $35,000 that Nicholson said was his pension from his days as a Russian spy.
Eric, I mean, you've seen a lot of unsealed in federal indictments in your time, but I'm mm-hmm. wondering if, when you looked at this one, did it feel bold and outrageous, or a little bit tawdry as you looked at the details?
A little bit of both. I can't remember reading about a case quite like this, and I talked to a number of espionage experts who described it in words like amazing and unique and unprecedented. The idea that he was able to and was brazen enough to use his own son and allegedly put him in considerable jeopardy is a sort of straight out of a John le Carré novel. Of course, the trial process will now just begin, and there may be another side to this. The other question is the security measures in place at the prison. The FBI was apparently monitoring and allowing this plot to go on for a period of months and even years. But there are questions as to the standard monitoring of mail and email and communications, and whether or not at an early stage, as far back as 2002, when Nicholson was allegedly trying to use other inmates to get messages out to the Russians, whether or not the proper security was in place.
Stephen Dubner's got your last question, Eric.
Eric, in your piece, he says he did it. He said he spied for the financial security of his kids. What does that say about the salary being paid to these guys?
It's funny. He referred over and over again in this indictment to his pension, not from the U.S. government as a 16-year employee of the CIA, but his pension from the Russians. He was making at the CIA, I believe, about $75,000 a year. He'd gone through a divorce that left him with some money troubles, and he saw this as his cash cow. He had made in his first career as a spy, had admitted making about $300,000 from the Russians. This time his son collected about $35,000. Not a lot of money by spy standards, but it's strange
sure.
what motivates people.
Well, but it's not so strange. They come straight out of Le Carré, because so many of the characters in Le Carré were worried about their pensions and were like putting away these nest eggs, and you can see the exact same narrative here. Eric, thanks so much.
Right. Thanks for having me.
Great story on the front page of the New York Times. Eric is the author of Bush's Law, The Remaking of American Justice. His story on a spy continuing to spy for the Russians while in prison is on the front page of the Times. So we want to know what to call the bad bank. You got any other ideas, Stephen Dubner, Freakonomics, our pal?
How about You Bet Your Assets?
That's what, or the Resolution Flush Corporation. That would work.
Or how about Very Interesting?
Adore You Doji is away. Stephen Dubner has been with us all hour. Thank you for that. I'm John Hockenberry. Of course, this could only be The Takeaway.